Blog Talk Radio. Coming to you today on August 27th with the Global Product Management Talk. I'm broadcasting from the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm delighted to have our speaker today from Silicon Valley, David Fraden, and our co-host, the lovely Adrian Tan, coming to us from Sydney, Australia.
Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Hello.
The Global Product Management Talk is for product professionals that don't get a chance to leave their desk and participate in product talks in person, so we bring them to you over Twitter and podcast. Each week, we feature an expert guest discussing pre-posted questions with the co-hosts and Twitter participants broadcast live over Blog Talk Radio. This is Cindy F. Solomon. You can follow me on Twitter at Cindy F. Solomon. You can find me on the web. You can also follow us, our tweeting today, at PRODMGMTTALK, and that is the acronym for everything Global Product Management Talk. That's our website, www.PRODMGMTTALK.com. And also, we just put up a startup little site from a startup we interviewed last week on Startup Talk Radio, www.dudada.com. You can go to dudada.com, dudada.com/prodmanagementtalk, and donate your appreciation for these broadcasts to help us to continue to improve the quality and the reach. We're currently reaching 10,000 listeners a week, which is very exciting. That is worldwide. Also, I'd like to thank our sponsor this week, the AIPMM, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management. You can visit them on the web at www.aipmm.com. They promote worldwide excellence in product management education by providing certification, educational opportunities, trainings, networking. And they are the only organization that provides certifications such as the Agile Certified Product Manager, the ACPM, the Certified Product Manager, CPM, Certified Product Marketing Manager, CPMM, Certified Brand Manager, CBM, and Certified Innovation Leader, CIL. These are credentials for professionals that are forwarding their professionalism and are not just based on an exam or a training. You have to actually demonstrate expertise. And I'll give you some more about our sponsor a little bit later. Also want to thank our podcastthemes.com and the great Mark Blasco for providing us with our intro theme music. Today we are talking about how product management can break or make your company with David Fraden, who is the president of Digital Enterprises. He'll be talking about product management factors that produce substantially more successful products. Multiple studies show that products fail 70 to 90% of the time. Nearly 98% of all patents fail to break even, and only 56% of new product introductions ever achieve their financial goals. Why do products fail? Well, for many reasons. They fail not because they don't function for the most part, but often because they don't address a big enough customer need at a price people will be eager to pay, or they were the wrong products to develop to begin with, or they may even have been the right product, but they were delivered to the wrong customer or positioned to target the wrong need. David promises that we will explore the vital role of product management and what factors must be present in building insanely great products that are substantially more successful. Just a little bit about David. He's the president of Digital Enterprises. He has over 30 years of product management, product marketing management, and senior management experience. Over the years, he's been responsible for more than 70 products, representing over $250 million in revenue. Welcome, David. Did I cover that? That's just a subset of all the information I have about David, so...
You did a great job, Cindy, but if you could just tell them about the rest of my background, we could fill up the rest of the hour and I wouldn't have to say anything.
Exactly.
You're funny.
So thanks for pointing out. I had mentioned to David, who's not a big tweeter yet, this is his entree into the tweeting world. And by the way, if you are out there tweeting, please use the hashtag POND, PRODMGMTTALK. That way we can capture the transcript of tweets, and we'll be posting our questions. Our first question is always to everyone, please introduce yourself, where you are tweeting from, and your involvement with product management.
Hi, everybody. It's Adrienne from BrainMate, a product management consultancy group in Australia. And I'm looking forward to having a chat with David today.
So the first question was pretty big, David, so maybe you can break it down for us.
Okay.
So Q1 is, what are the foundations that companies must have in order for a product manager to do their job?
Number one foundation is that they have to have a company set of values that everybody in the company knows, understands, and subscribes to. And then they need a vision for the company that everybody in the company also agrees upon, because it is against those two sets of things, values and vision, that all decisions about products and services are made. If in the instance where, and there are many companies like this, they don't have a clear set of values or they don't have a clear set of vision, then when they go into their product meetings discussing whatever it may be, the features, the price, the positioning, and so forth, each one of those people has a different view of the world, a different view of the company, a different view of the values of the company, and thus their decision-making reflects whatever their values and their vision is. If there's commonality and alignment amongst everybody in terms of values and vision, then the decision-making process specifically about products goes much smoother. It's a very interesting concept, and I rediscovered it as I was in the process of writing my book entitled Building Insanely Great Products. And recently I was in the country of Singapore speaking to about 70 CXOs about the role of product management, because the country of Singapore has 157,000 people working in the IT services area, and they've recognized that in order to replicate business as opposed to services, they have to move into the product area. And one of the executives came up to me afterwards and said he's heard many management consultants talking about the importance of a company mission statement or a company vision or a company values. And what I just said, the combination of values and vision to create a culture and a foundation for decision making, is a connecting of the dots that he hadn't realized before.
Can you give us some examples of how you would, you know, embody your values and your vision in, you know, what product managers do on a day-to-day basis, which is, they're probably in meetings, they're talking about, you know, what features should be in this release, what features shouldn't, or they're talking to customers. How do you, you know, take, how do you apply it?
It's a good question. Two good examples of companies that have blended values and vision is Hewlett-Packard up until about 1998, which is now split off, and it's a company called Agilent. And the second company is Apple, which continues to follow that philosophy to this day, and it's contributed to them being the most valuable company in the world. In the case of HP, for 50 years, by following this formula of having a good set of values, which people called the HP way, and a vision statement, which is that they will not do anything unless it can make a technical good technical contribution, and that it's of quality and of value to their customers. That company, HP, grew 20% a year for 50 years. And then when Carly Farina took over, and later, they dropped the HP way as a set of values, and the company has been spiraling out of control ever since. And about 3 weeks ago, Meg Whitman from Goldman Sachs, the new president of HP, announced layoffs of 27,000 people over the next few years. In the case of Apple, in the late 70s, they put together a set of values and a vision, which continues to be used in all of their decision-making to this day, except for a period after Steve Jobs had left in 1985 until he came back and reinstituted the HP values in 1998. A good example of the use of that is I was the group product manager for the Apple III product line, and at the time Apple was shipping two products, the Apple II and the Apple III, and the executive management made a decision to cancel the product line, but they didn't bother to tell me about it. When they finally asked me what they should do with the $20 million of inventory that they had, and they had no idea how to get rid of it since they had canceled the product line, I told them that you needed to give me the authority as a product manager, as a group line product manager, commensurate with the responsibility. They asked me what my recommendation is and suggested I put together a business plan, which I presented to the executive committee of the board on July 15th, 1983, a day, at least in my mind, which will live in infamy. And one of my marketing communications managers, Maxine Graham, suggested that we compare the decisions, the five alternative decisions we could make against Apple values. And I had never thought of that before. And it turns out I think Maxine was also on the Apple Values Committee in the late 1970s. So we did. And one of the options for the decision of the executive committee was to cancel the product line right then and there, as they had done 3 weeks before. And the other option that we gave them is let the market decide whether or not the product will continue to live and thrive on based upon sales. And at that point in the meeting, Floyd Kwame, who was our executive vice president, asked me if a dealer called me and the board had, or the executive committee had decided to cancel the product line versus letting the product line survive as long as the market was still interested in it, what would I say? I said, if you decide to continue the product line, that I would tell the dealers, and I had 1,800 dealers worldwide at the time, I would tell the dealer to continue to sell the product and tell customers Apple will continue to support it and develop it so long as people continue to buy the product. We'll let the market decide. And that fit perfectly in consideration and empathy for customers, which is one of the Apple values. Then I said, Floyd, if the decision is to cancel the product line coming out of this meeting, that would be inconsistent with Apple values, and I would give the dealer your phone number.
That's a pretty big example, but could you break it down a little bit further by perhaps giving us, I mean, you've used empathy towards customers as a value. How would we take that as product managers and embody that in our day-to-day activity? Could you just take that down a little bit further so that people have some tips to take back to their desk today?
Sure. In the area of pricing, for example, values and vision plays an enormous role. What's your goal? Are you going after profitability? Are you going after shareholder value? Are you going after keeping people employed? Are you going after being the low-cost producer? All of those things factor in, depending upon which one you're going after, in terms of deciding what price you're going to set for your product or your service. And if you
Wouldn't
think through...
strategy, though? Isn't that what you're talking about, some sort of corporate business strategy? And I completely agree with you that if part of your strategic plan, absolutely that shapes the way that we, that shapes the decisions that we make. But what I'm hearing is that it's sort of more elevated than strategy. It's the way that the company behaves.
Yes, it's the criteria against which the decisions of pricing is made. If, for example, there's confusion over the values and the vision of the company, and one group sets prices in order to get market share, while another group is trying to establish the product as a high-quality, valuable product, then the brand, the overall brand of the company becomes confusing to the customer.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Is there more to... the first questions, which are the foundations that a company must have in order for a product manager to do their job, apart from values and vision, what else do we need?
Well, once once a company has that, and it doesn't really matter how large or how small the company is, they all have to have it in one way or another. Typically in startups, that's somewhere buried in the brain of the founder, and sometimes they express it well, sometimes they don't at all. And if they don't at all, and those are the kinds of people that don't share the business plan with their employees because they're afraid someone might steal their game plan, and then everyone doesn't know which way to run when the bell rings. Once you have that, then you need an organizational structure that fits into that vision and values and culture. And then above that, you need the people that are able to implement it, and they've got to be properly trained and have the right experience and the skill sets. And then you need to have the process of handling the product life cycle. One of the things I found recently in consulting with a company that had brought out 5 products and they all failed, and they asked us to come in and help them design a product lifecycle process, is that without having a process, they were developing a culture of blame, where the product would fail and one group would point their fingers at other groups and saying that that was the ones that were at fault. So they recognized that they had to come up with a process that they can all agree with. So above vision, values, and culture, you need to have the organizational structure. You have to be working with the right information, and that includes market research and customer research. And then you have to have the right people, and if they don't have the skill sets, they need to get trained up to be able to do the role of product management. And they have to have a process for their product lifecycle in order to proceed and be successful.
And within that process, what else do you think we need?
I've advocated over the years the use of a RACI chart or a DACI chart. That is, not everybody has to be the decision maker on everything that goes on in terms of the product decisions. Not everybody is the approver. Not everybody is a contributor. Not everybody has to be informed. So I encourage in all of the documents used in documenting the product lifecycle that a RACI or DACI chart exists. And you get everybody that's listed on it, which is consists of the product council, sign the thing in blood, and don't change the aim of whose roles is who in the middle of the product lifecycle. Do a retrospective at the end of each phase, each one of the, what I'm talking about is the AI, PMM, product lifecycle phases.
Right.
After each gate has been passed, and modify the RACI chart afterwards. And then the second part of that, as have exit criteria for each of the phases that AIPMM recommends.
I'm not familiar with RACI chart or DACI chart. So how would you spell that, David?
DACI stands for decision maker. A, the A is approver. R is recommender, I think. And I is informed. And then RACI comes from the field of project management. And I've heard exactly what the RACI stands for, but it's along those same kinds of lines. If you look it up under Wikipedia, it describes it in more articulate detail than I just did.
Thank you.
And it's a matrix. You have the decisions that need to be made throughout the product lifecycle or through the phase and the rows, and the columns are the people that are making the decisions. The head of marketing, the head of product management, the head of engineering, executive management, the CFO, the service and support organization, and so forth.
So we're talking about a substantial sized and mature organization that would not only have a product council, but would have a need for such a formal process in place, as well as be able to handle many products being developed at once?
No, not at all. I think every organization from the startup all the way up to the biggest companies of the world need these kinds of decision charts. I was training a company in construction software in Portland, Oregon, a couple of months ago, and I was talking about this as part of the training, and the VP of product management was there, and he's one of the 3 founders of the company when it was started 20 years ago. He says, you know, we had a DACI chart when we started the company. That's how we split up the authorities and responsibilities amongst the 3 founders. We got away from it. And ever since we got away from it, we began to have chaos. And it's a way of restoring structure to the process, and everybody knows what their roles and responsibilities are, even in the smallest organizations.
thing. It's probably Melissa at the 280 group who tweeted that DACI, D-A-C-I, stands for decision maker, approver, contributor, and informed. Thanks, Melissa.
That's it. She's smarter than I am, too.
I just thought I'd just quickly summarize what our conversation so far has been. In terms of, you know, foundations of companies that, in terms of what companies must have in order for product management to succeed, so far I've heard, number one, you need to have aligned values and vision. You should use that in your day-to-day sort of decision-making process to help you guide your decisions. Number two, you should have a pretty solid product delivery process where everybody understands their role within that process. I mean, at each step, there should be some clear exit criteria.
Q2, 70 to 90% of product fail. What can a product manager do to reduce that failure rate?
Well, the things that product managers could specifically do is make sure that the product that's built meets what the market needs, make sure that it's clear who the customer is, make sure that if there is competition and the competitor is somebody other than do nothing, that it is competitive, and put themselves in the shoes of the buyer, and if presented with the customer's, their product versus the competitor's product, how they would make a decision. If the product costs too much to build based upon the value and hence what customers are willing to pay, if there's no urgent need for the product, in other words, the unique selling proposition, the key selling points are not clear and moving and motivating as opposed to baffling the prospective customer with BS, or the market just simply isn't big enough. Could be the biggest and best product in the market, but if the market research hasn't been done in terms of the total available market and you have the distribution to get to it, the product could be a failure. On the marketing side, now I was just talking in the product development side. On the marketing side, there are four things that the product marketing manager can do, and that is make sure that the value proposition is made very clear to the customer, make sure that the product is properly priced, make sure that they have a channel, and they've picked a channel that the target customer is looking at buying their product through, and make sure, and we talked about this earlier, that the product is congruent with the company's brand.
It's a lot for a product manager to do. How do you do all of that?
There's 5 days in the week.
Okay. How should we split it up?
Well, the first ones I mentioned before I switched to saying product marketing manager should really be two people. So the first 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 things is the responsibility of product management. The last 4 things I mentioned is the responsibility of the product marketing manager.
Right. And are you seeing those clear role distinctions in companies in the U.S.?
They're beginning to develop. We all have to remember that the field of product management started in 1931 with a memo from Neil McElroy at Procter & Gamble about the role of brand management. And he mixed both what we today we call product management and product marketing management together in one entity. He also gave those guys a budget, and they managed the market research, and they managed the advertising budget and the branding budgets and so forth. Over the years, product managers have lost, in general, the authority and the budget, and now they're given all the responsibility, very little authority to get the job done. And then in the 1970s and 1980s, people in engineering were given the job as a product manager. Sometimes people refer to them as a technical product manager. And some of them started migrating sort of as an exodus out of engineering into marketing. And then they got all involved in all the marketing things like demos and trade shows and advertising and now, I guess, social media and that type of thing. And companies are flying along without anybody doing the product management task, and that is being the voice of the customer and knowing what the customer wants and needs, as I talked about earlier. Recently, several years ago, the more modern companies have their own division of product management. At Apple, is the vice president of product management. The VP of product management at Facebook sits at the same table predate Mark Zuckerman. So the good companies, and I'm this for my book, are those that have a sort of independent, neutral division product, and they're not stuck in marketing product market, and they're not stuck in engineering, where the product manager's job is to define the problem and let engineering define the solution or how to do it. They're in their own division. And I mentioned five to the present to identify what is it in companies that is driving. For example, Steve Jobs talks of is what Apple tried to build, or build. They're the closest one to what I think is the ideal, and that is a company that's market-driven, a company that's listening to their customers, and they're concerned about total customer satisfaction, customer relationship. The other companies that are, for example,
I didn't want to interrupt you because I was hearing like every three words. And by the way, if you're listening, there's also a chat at Blog Talk Radio. If you're not a tweeter, you can let me know how you can hear on the chat. If you logged into blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMPTALK. So I heard up to you were mentioning a company. And then I didn't hear you at all.
Did you hear me, my mention of Apple?
Partly. Could you repeat
okay.
that?
So you got half of Apple.
Yes.
It's really interesting, this technology. I'm in Saratoga, California, located in the heart. And by the way, it's Silicon Valley. It's not silicone. Silicone is what women use. Silicon is what is used to make chips, and that's how Silicon Valley got the name right. That was the first thing I was corrected on when I moved to Silicon Valley. And the second thing that's important to know is that San Francisco is not Cisco, it's the city. So if you want to impress your friends and the $7 billion in venture capital spent in Silicon Valley, you'll know both of those things and you won't be embarrassed. So what I was talking about in terms of Apple is that when I was there, and Steve Wozniak was recently in Perth, Australia, and he said the same thing, that there was this huge battle going on between the marketing department and the engineering departments as to whether or not Apple was marketing-driven or engineering-driven. And when Steve Jobs came back, as he had emphasized previously at Apple up until he left in 1985, is that it's all about the product and the experience that the customer, that the market has with the product. So I'm doing a study of Fortune 500 companies since 1965, and what kind of company are they driven by? So, for example, for a while there, IBM became a manufacturing-driven company, and IBM almost had great financial difficulties until they turned it around and changed their corporate strategy. I'm convinced that the companies of the future that will succeed in an insanely great way are those companies that are market-driven, that are focused on their customers' needs and wants and satisfaction.
So apart from Apple, and I think you mentioned Facebook when you were sort of cutting in and out, what other companies are or do you consider to be market-driven? Could you name a few?
I can name 200.
Please
and they all start with one word, Virgin.
Okay,
Virgin America,
fantastic.
Virgin Atlantic,
yep.
Virgin Mobile, Virgin Music, Virgin Spacecraft. Virgin Australia. I didn't want to leave you out, Adrian.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you.
Richard Branson has the same philosophy.
Right. Okay. Interesting.
In
I wonder whether he has product managers. Do you think he's got product managers in his business?
Well, I think
I don't
Branson
know.
Is a genius. He's a maniac and a genius.
I suspect he has to. He certainly does in each of the companies. I'm not sure what he calls them.
Yeah.
They're probably brand managers because they're very consumer-focused.
Yeah, and that would fit. That would fit. That's a good question. I'll research that. I'll give Richard a call this afternoon.
Excellent.
Hey,
tell him you said Florida.
Yes, will you invite him to be on the show, please? Well,
sure.
We're on the schedule to accommodate him.
Sure.
We'll even broadcast next week, which is Labor Day, if that's when Richard wants to be on.
They don't have any labor in England, so it doesn't matter.
That's right.
And so apart from Virgin Everything, what other companies do you think are market-driven?
Oh, I'd have to think that through. I'd have to look, by the way, at my list, because I've got the list together with all of the numbers, and I haven't gone through it yet and classified them as to which ones were market-driven and when. But if you give me a week or two, I'll answer that question. I'll give you a complete list.
Yeah, and so how do you classify, you know, when you look around at all these fabulous companies, how do you pick the market-driven ones, the ones that perform well or the ones that...
It's the other way around.
Criteria.
I perform well is after you have a market focus.
Yeah.
A couple just occurred to me. Agilent, the old HP, is market-focused. One of the Apple culture things is called the next bench syndrome, that if you build a product that the person at the next bench could use and wants, then the chances of it succeeding in the marketplace is much higher. And that's pretty much what Steve Jobs did with all of his products, but not all of them were that way. But that's another hour discussion. So Agilent, the old HP, up until Carly came in from sales at the old AT&T, and before what's-his-name Heard came in, and his focus was financial, cost-cutting, margins, and not product or market. Intel is market-driven. Applied Materials is market-driven. AMD is market-driven. What's the graphics company that a lot of computers use? There's tons
Adobe.
Of them. Adobe has lost its way. I don't think Adobe has been market-driven since they acquired Macromedia. They've had major, major markets that they could dominate, that they did dominate, that they don't dominate anymore. And they've been ejecting good people consistently for the last 5 to 10 years.
But so how do you, sorry, go ahead.
I, that's all.
No, I guess I like to understand how you would classify them as market-driven. If results come after, which I completely agree with you, what is it that would suggest to you that they're market-driven? Is it a particular behavior in the market, or because you know people in the business, or you've seen maybe some of their workings, their processes? What is it that would make you decide that they're market-driven?
That's a good question. It would be all of those things. So, for example, Comcast, my cable carrier, is rapidly improving in terms of their consideration on the market. AT&T, my mobile carrier, is doing the same thing. 2-3 years ago, if you had a problem with either of those, you got better customer service by tweeting about how bad they are. And they were monitoring their social media, and then their customer service rep would call you up and fix the problem. Just the other day, I talked to AT&T, and I said, I got a $444 charge because I turned on Google Maps when I was in London and I was lost. And she says, oh, my God, and the Google Maps downloaded over 2 gigabytes worth of data. And it was triggered because I got a phone call from the United States. And so they said, okay, we'll give you $150 back on that. Is that good enough? But I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and he went to Canada, and he used Google Maps and got a $1,500 charge.
On AT&T?
Well, from AT&T because of the roaming thing. And he got a full refund. So I think over time, those companies will start notifying people that these things might happen and take steps so that they don't lose the customer loyalty as a result of those kinds of charges. And by the way, I had data roaming off on my iPhone when I was in England, yet the charge still came through.
Wow. It reminds me of when we used to have dial-up modem, and people would log on to AOL and not know that they were paying for the phone charges to connect.
Correct.
So, But find out and let us know how your colleague got paid back by AT&T. I think it is their policy not to pay people back.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll tweet about that. We'll fix it.
Yeah. So you raise a good point that it's, perhaps embodied in their customer service philosophy and their customer service practices. But is there anything else that would say, yeah, you know, you rock as a market-driven company? I can tell because of X.
It's all the things that you mentioned earlier.
Okay.
And I would kick back and maybe read their annual report and look at their satisfaction ratings. And this, I think, applies not only to business-to-customer companies, but also applies to business-to-business companies. Like I mentioned, the manufacturing focus of IBM in the 80s led to their problems in the late 80s, early 90s. General Motors was another one that was listening to the management gurus of the day, and they decided to take the same drivetrain out of the $50,000 Cadillac and put it in the $10,000 Chevy, because their brand strategy was Chevy at the low end, and you move up through, Pontiac and Buick, Oldsmobile, and then Cadillac. And the market learned that, hey, I can buy a $10,000 Chevy, get the same drivetrain that you get in a Cadillac, so why should I bother buying a Cadillac? And that was the beginning of some of the problems of General Motors when they became manufacturing driven, as opposed to what Sloan set up, a market driven company in the beginning.
Right. Excellent. I know we're I'm mindful of the time, so perhaps I could ask you question three. How much can the failure rate of new products be reduced?
Well, I asked a bunch of my fellow product management consultants, and using a very elaborate Delphi method, since they actually know something about the subject, we've all come to an agreement that failure rate could probably be reduced by at least 50% with good professional product management. And that translates into millions or billions of dollars in savings of development that goes nowhere.
Right. And if we can reduce the failure rate by 50%, which is significant,
it's huge.
Why aren't companies doing better at product management? I mean, if this is the answer, why
don't
people
think I don't think they really know about it. This subject is generally not taught in any business school, any place in the world. They senior management, the ones with the MBA degrees, they know all about marketing and market share and positioning and brand management. They don't know much because they're not taught how to shut up and go talk to their customers.
Yeah, it's very simple. Hello?
Yes.
It seems quite obvious, though.
Yeah.
And certainly this is, what Steve Blank professes in being customer-driven. It's get out of the building and listen to the customers. How else can you develop? It just seems so obvious. It's hard to believe that it's not built into the DNA of every company.
That's because they're preoccupied with other key performance indicators. Like in the last, 10 to 20 years, there's a whole group of executives that think that the whole purpose that a corporation exists is to enhance shareholder value. Well, that then gets driven by what Wall Street thinks about them. And how can anything be more ridiculous than a stock price that goes down because the company did not meet the consensus revenue and profitability goals of a bunch of people on Wall Street that have no idea what's going on inside that company's operations? And even though the company exceeded their own internal CFOs and department's projections, the Wall Street hammers the stock because it didn't meet the expectations of people that don't know what they're talking about. And if you don't believe me, go look at the last Apple report to investors, last month? And because that happened to Apple, their share price went down. So it all depends upon what the key performance indicators are. Part of the problem is executive compensation is based upon the stock price. So they're going to do anything they can to manipulate that stock price. It's not long-term investor value. It's not customer satisfaction. It's a, but it's a
bad.
So this is the first time that I've heard product management being the solution to the woes of our current economy.
Well, you heard it here first.
Thanks, David.
write this down in your diary.
I completely agree with you. You know, I champion what you say as well, and you try and live it every day. But, you know, I'm still dumbfounded, I guess, that that people don't sort of want to adopt some of these very simple practices. And I'm wondering what you think we can do to sort of change that.
We need to climb up to the tallest mountain and scream about it. The solution to the unemployment problem in the United States and for the rest of the world is the same thing. Can you imagine if we had lower failure rates of products and we had more products that are successful, producing more profits that will not only hire more people, but will also give a better return on investment for the investors? It's not like in the current presidential campaign, and I have to say this while a hurricane interrupted the Republican convention, government does not create jobs. They create the environment and then they get out of the way. But the key there is you got to build products that people want to want and buy, and
or
government
buy.
Does. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Agree. And do you see, and this is a really interesting off-topic, sorry, but I can't help myself. Do you see, like, your government adopting this sort of thinking, product management thinking? Because we see some of it here, actually, in Australia, because we do a lot of work in government.
If the key performance indicator is increasing shareholder value, which is coming from one of our political parties, then the answer is no. If the key performance indicator is creating jobs, there is a possibility if I can get a chance to talk to some of the right people.
That would be great.
I used to be in Washington, and I used to be in Washington, and I did talk to the right people, and a few of those people have changed over the years.
Right. Bummer. So moving on to question four, what drives your company and how does that affect product management? And I guess that's open to everybody rather than you.
that question revolves around what I was talking about before. Is the company engineering driven? Is it marketing driven?
Yeah.
I identified a bunch of things that could be driving a company. Let me find my list here.
I love a list.
Could be technology driven. That's a big one that venture capitalists look at. They say, well, if you got this fantastic technology, then we'll invest in you. But what they really mean to say is, do you have a technology that solves a customer's problem or want or need better and faster or with greater satisfaction than another technology? Because, for example, the word processor on a computer is nothing new. The market for writing things down on something and saving it existed going all the way back to the caveman and a lump of charcoal, which then got wrapped with a bunch of wood, and we called it a pencil, and then someone invented the pen and that you used to dip in ink, and then the ballpoint pen later, and then you had the Gutenberg press, and on and on and on. And markets exist. A lot of people say that Apple invented the iPod market. No, they didn't. The mobile music market existed and was owned by Sony long before Apple entered into it. Apple's strategy was to pick a huge market that they could come in and make a difference. Other companies are legally driven, like Eastman Kodak right now is doing nothing more than trying to sell off their patents. A bunch of companies, especially in corrupt nations, are government-driven. Some of them are driven by Wall Street, and Wall Street's driven by greed and fear. Some are human resources driven. I remember watching from the outside of as Apple was spinning into its death spiral that the HR department took away from managers the authority to hire and fire. Some companies are driven by councils, whereby, for example, in 1993, decision making that HP used to drive to the lowest levels of the organization had floated up to these product councils across multiple divisions and groups. Decision making stopped, such that HP's growing 20% per year for 50 years stopped. As soon as they blew up those councils, HP's growth returned to what it used to be for the next several years until they hired Charlie. Some companies are labor-driven, and we see many times that the demands of labor has brought a company to its knees, and in the case of the American automotive industry, forced the car manufacturers to move south to states that did not have labor unions. Some are community-driven. Some are driven by ego and spite. If you read Walter Isaacson's job, he had over. I had dinner with a guy and a bunch of other people from Microsoft, and this guy was bragging much about their tablet computer. It pissed him off, so he looked at the concept of building the iPad and did it. I got 16 different things I've identified that drive companies.
Right. That's fantastic. You should tweet about that list. You should send us the list.
Okay.
And so finally, last question. I've got 10 minutes. If you manage products and someone at a cocktail party asks you what you do, what do you say? What do you say, David?
I have no idea. That's been my biggest problem.
Yeah.
You know, it's terribly embarrassing because you're trying to impress the ladies and what you do, and they usually leave you.
Oh, no. That's tragic. You need to find other product management women.
Yeah, we need to come up with, as a community, a five-word statement that just shakes the boots of everybody around us. Some people suggest we're mini CEO, and then I think of mini me and that movie. So that I don't like that one.
No, I don't like either.
Sometimes I say I'm responsible for the development of successful products, and by the time I get to the fourth word, their eyes glaze over and they go talk to some hunk walking by. I don't know. I think one of our challenges as a community, we need to come up with a tagline on what we do.
I think that's a fantastic idea. I think, Cindy, you should open that up to everybody. We need to come up with a tagline.
So
we need to brand product management.
Yeah, every month at the San Francisco Startup Product Talks meetup, I post a question: what is product management? How do you define product? What does it mean to be a product manager? And every month we have someone else trying to answer it or giving us insights. And product management, I think, as a term is not sexy. But to be a product person, I think that's very hot.
Mm. We've got product, a few product, product people.
I'm a product
yes, person. You're all static, David. Maybe you should calm down here. You say you're a product person? Okay, you're really static, David. So I don't know. Maybe unplug and plug back in.
I'm using a Mac and it just works.
Okay. Yeah. Well, except when it doesn't. And I can say that because I did used to work for Apple, and actually I worked for a software subsidiary after they bought Claris, and they left out FileMaker, and the IT department was at the opposite end of this huge building from where marketing was. It was IT was downstairs and marketing was upstairs, a mile away. So, but that was before they realized that marketing needs to work with IT to make a difference. Having nothing to, just a non sequitur there. So we're talking about if you manage products, what do you say that you do? Well, I think that managing products are essential to every business, every company. Without product management, you don't have a company. every company, whether they have someone whose title is product management, every company, every business is in the job of managing products. They're doing it whether they have a process for it, whether they call it that or not. And
yeah.
I agree with you, David, that if they were doing it intentionally, if they had a clear system, process, if they had educated people and experienced people in that role, it would make a huge difference. And it's always a shame when there is a good product, but they don't know how to reach the market, or they're not listening to the customers. It's just sad. On the other hand, I do see a lot of startups and a lot of new products coming out that don't have a problem that they're being solved. They're an answer to someone thought it would be a good idea to develop these products, and I also think that what a waste of brain power when those excellent people could be working on solving a much bigger problem. So this is why I engage in these conversations on a regular basis, weekly. However, we will be off next week, for it is a United States holiday. So the following week, on September 10th, we will be talking with Prabhakar Gopalan about Gestalt product management, doing product strategy with a Gestalt mind. So that should be very philosophical, and Prabhakar has been on several times. He speaks very fast. He's a brilliant thinker, and I invite you to come join us on September 10th. In the meantime, please listen to our more than 50 podcasts in our archives. We've covered every bit of the seven-phase product management lifecycle that AIPMM covers in the framework, from conception to deliver to even sunsetting. So please listen to us, our archives. You can find them on iTunes as well by just search for PRODMGMTTALK. You will find our Twitter transcripts. You will find MP3s. And you can follow on Blog Talk Radio and get reminders every week. Thank you, David Frieden, for joining us this week. Thank you, Adrian, for joining us from Australia again this week. We'll be off next week. Thank you to our sponsor, the AIPMM. Please follow AIPMM.com/webinars. There is a webinar on Wednesday talking about certification and how to become a certified product manager. There is a webinar coming up about European certification and how product management is different in Europe than it is in the United States. So check out AIPMM.com for upcoming webinars and subscribe to the AIPMM Product Management News and Views, where the weekly product talks are featured. You can find out about the new ones coming up. We just put up a little site on dudata.com/PRODMGMTTALK where you can show your love and contribute to our podcast improving on a regular basis. I'd like to go into a studio to increase our audio quality. The podcast will be edited and available in the next 36 hours. The tweets will be up. I will post on Twitter so you can find the transcript to today's tweet. And, David, you'll have to come back and go through each of those 200 companies that you say are marketing-driven.
Love to, and I'll write new jokes, too.
Great.
And, David, thank you so much for chatting to us. I really appreciate it. It was very nice to get your perspective on product management.
I hope to be finishing my book soon, so I have lots of things to talk about.
Great.
Fantastic.
Awesome. So we will catch you on Twitter and offline. Have a great 2 weeks if you're here in the States, and we'll catch you next on September 10th. Thanks, everyone who listened today.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.